This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
How could you become any more inspired than what these statements express? They are like the tongue of angels.
Coming up next, letters from Liberty Jail.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
KJAZ Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
December the 1st, 1838. Joseph Smith and five others were imprisoned in the jail at Liberty, Clay County, Missouri. While they were there, the Latter-day Saints were driven from the state, primarily eastward toward Quincy, Illinois. Joseph and his friends suffered terrible privation in that cold, dark dungeon. It was near the end of their stay there that the prophet Joseph Smith dictated a two-part letter, an epistle, really. And it is from that epistle that in the modern Doctrine and Covenants we have sections 121 through 123.
Gordon A. Madsen.
The longest letter that Joseph Smith ever wrote that we currently have was dated March the 20th, 1839, written from Liberty Jail. It was addressed to Bishop Partridge and the church, but sent to his wife, Emma, with instructions for her to decide with whom it should be shared. That was because Joseph, even as of March of 1839, after 4 months' imprisonment, still wasn't certain who was loyal and who was not among the leaders left now in Quincy, Illinois.
Alexander L. Baugh.
What prompted Joseph Smith to write this letter was, I think, a few things. Number one, he had just received a packet of letters from some of his associates and also Emma. He had just received those a day or two previous or whatever, and so he's very touched by the letters.
Joseph said, "We had been a long time without information. And when we read those letters, they were to our souls as the gentle air is refreshing. But our joy was mingled with grief because of the sufferings of the poor and much injured saints. And we need not say to you that the floodgates of our hearts were lifted and our eyes were a fountain of tears. But those who have not been enclosed in the walls of prison without cause or provocation can have but little idea how sweet the voice of a friend is."
Robert J. Woodford.
And so on the 20th of March, he began an epistle for the members of the church, but particularly for Edward Partridge.
The brethren had received information from Israel Barlow, others who were over in Quincy, that a man by the name of Isaac Galland was willing to help the saints secure land in the area of Montrose, Iowa, and Commerce, Illinois. And perhaps one of the reasons this letter was also directed to Edward Partridge, who is the bishop, is because he gives them full license to go ahead and negotiate the possible purchase of land and property from Isaac Galland if they feel that's okay and the right thing to do.
Alexander McRae wrote it, as Joseph Smith dictated it. And so the original epistle is in the historical department of the church. It's in Alexander McRae's handwriting, but it is signed by the five prisoners who were there.
That letter was 29 pages long and was divided into two parts, the first portion of which was begun on March the 20th.
It looks like they kind of closed up after one day. And they actually signed their names to the document.
The next day, Joseph Smith wrote in his own hand a note to his wife, Emma, instructing her, because he was going to send the epistle to her, to read it, to pass it on to his father and mother, and then to pass it on to the other church leaders. And then within a couple of days after that, I guess he reckoned that he hadn't said enough in the epistle, so he had Alexander McRae write while he dictated the second part of it. And so there are actually three letters involved. When B.H. Roberts put the history together, he decided that rather than divide them into two, he would just make them as one with no division in between the two. And so when people read this in the history of the church, it seems to be one epistle dated March 25th, but it's not. Within 3 weeks after writing this epistle, he's allowed to escape. And so the epistle got to Quincy, Illinois. It was addressed to Emma Smith at Quincy, probably just a few days before he arrived. There is no postage on any one of the three letters, and so I suspect that somebody hand-carried them, but I don't know who. These two epistles were published 2 years later in the May and July issues of the Times and Seasons. Then they were published out here in Utah in the Deseret News in 1854, and later in the Millennial Star. So they had some distribution up till that time. In 1873-74, sometime in that time period, Brigham Young had Orson Pratt work on a new edition of the Doctrine and Covenants. He finished it in 1876. And in this edition of the DNC, he included 26 additional revelations that had never been in the book before, including what we now call sections 121, 2, and 3. And the material for those three revelations were extracted from these Liberty Jail letters. We have the church historian's journal for that period, and it tells that Orson Pratt is doing the work, but it gives no clue at all about what authorization he was given concerning these revelations, what parts of sections one of the Liberty Jail letters would be put into sections 121 and 2 and 3. Just no clue at all. So we don't know the criteria by which the material was selected.
Orson Pratt did a very, very good job of recognizing where these, where this aspect of the writing is very, very elevated. It's not Joseph so much the man speaking as it is Joseph in a prophetic voice. And you can see it as anyone reads that letter. All of a sudden, you know, Joseph Smith speaking in very normal, expressive terms. And then all of a sudden, you know, O Lord, where art thou? Where is the pavilion that covereth thy hiding place? He normally couldn't express himself that way if he was just talking as Joseph Smith. But he obviously was empowered by a higher spiritual endowment of power and of the Holy Ghost.
Some people have dared to call Joseph Smith a plowboy prophet. Others have talked about him being an uneducated man. But what I see in the Liberty Jail letters is a man who is well-educated, very, very articulate, and who can say things. His prose is just magnificent, I think.
The handwriting is Alexander McRae's, so the punctuation and the spelling are chargeable to him. But the words are Joseph's. Moreover, they show rather clearly that this was no uneducated New York farm boy. This is now a self-educated man with a rather remarkable vocabulary.
So what we read then in sections 121 through 123 are portions of that original epistle. And while they are significant enough as they stand, it is nonetheless fascinating how the original epistle as a whole expands the historical context and deepens our understanding. The first epistle opens up with Joseph Smith describing the awful persecution that the saints have endured in northern Missouri. He said this, "The inhumanity and murderous disposition of this people, it shocks all nature. It beggars and defies all description. It is a tale of woe, a lamentable tale, yea, a sorrowful tale too much to tell. Yea, and I think it cannot be found among the wild and ferocious beasts of the forest that a man should be mangled for sport, women be robbed of all that they have, their last morsel for subsistence, and then be violated to gratify the hellish desires of the mob, and finally left to perish with their helpless offspring clinging around their necks.
Let me just quote a little piece here. They practice those things upon the saints who have done them no wrong, who are innocent and virtuous, who love the Lord their God and were willing to forsake all things for Christ's sake. These things are awful to relate, but they are verily true. It must needs be their offenses come, but woe unto them by whom they come. O God, where art thou? And where is the pavilion that covereth thy hiding place? Now, you'd recognize that immediately as verse 1 of DNC 121. And that goes on for two paragraphs, and that would be verses 1 through 6 of section 121.
And then this.
Let thine anger be kindled against our enemies, and in fury of thine heart with thy sword avenge us of our wrongs. And, of course, the saints have suffered. And so he says, remember thy suffering saints, O our God, and thy servants will rejoice in thy name forever. He just wants to make sure that God will punish the wicked for what they've done to the saints. After Joseph Smith's expression of hope that retribution will be someday meted out against the Missourians and those who caused all the pain and the sorrow and the hurt, Joseph Smith receives a personal, and that's the only way you can say it, a personal divine assurance that God is with him. And it's one of the most powerful expressions of that assurance anywhere, in which the Lord says, my son, peace be unto thy soul. Thine adversity and thine affliction shall be but a small moment.
And of that adversity, Joseph said this.
And now, beloved brethren, we say unto you that inasmuch as God hath said that he would have a tried people, that he would purge them as gold, now we think that this time he has chosen his own crucible wherein we have been tried. And we think if we get through with any degree of safety, we shall have kept the faith, and that it'll be a sign to this generation, altogether sufficient to lead them without excuse. And we think also it will be a trial of our faith, to that equal to that of Abraham, and that the ancients will not have whereof to boast over us in the day of judgment, as being called to pass through heavier afflictions. And then he goes on to say, now we need to hold on and be faithful.
Well, I think we can safely say that Joseph Smith and his prison companions experienced extreme physical hardship during these 4-plus months that they're in Liberty Jail. Number one, it's cold. The bottom portion of that jail is not heated. Those windows are open. The barred windows are basically open windows. They probably had to stuff a few blankets in there to try to keep the cold out. They can't light a fire. It'd be smoked out, but the majority of their time was spent in a 14-by-14.5-foot cell. Certainly unpleasant, no accommodations, straw beds, straw ticks, cold weather. Boy, that would just take it out of anybody. For just a matter of a couple of days would cause one to have, be extremely discouraged.
And then, in the context of that suffering, which, by the way, was brought on by unfaithful friends, the voice of the Lord continues.
Thou art not yet as Job. Job suffered extreme physical hardship, but he even lost more. I mean, he lost family, he lost friends, and had a physical suffering far more than Joseph in terms of ailments and bodily disease and affliction. And so the Lord's trying to tell Joseph, I know you've suffered. This has not been pleasant. You're not quite as Job yet. And besides, you still have friends. The men who did all this terrible these terrible kinds of activities against Latter-day Saints, they will pay. They will be punished. This point I'm making is easily summarized in one verse. Woe unto all those that discomfort my people and drive and murder and testify against them, saith the Lord of hosts. A generation of vipers shall not escape the damnation of hell.
It was in part two of the letter that Joseph Smith dictated this line, many are called, but few are chosen. Now, he said that in the context of men in the councils of the church who, as he described it, aspire after their own aggrandizement and seek their own opulence, while their brethren are groaning in poverty and are under sore trials and temptations.
Behold, there are many called, but few are chosen. And why are they not chosen? Because their hearts are set so much upon the things of this world, and they aspire to the honors of men, that they do not learn this one lesson, that the rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with the powers of heaven, that the powers of heaven cannot be controlled nor handled upon only upon principles of righteousness. What prompted Joseph Smith to write that passage? And I think it's very clear. He's saying, look at all these early, these men who are associated with me from the beginning. Your David Whitmers, your John Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery, Martin Harris. Their actions clearly manifest that although chosen by God at one time, or called by God, that's the better word, called by God at one time, no longer. They're no longer chosen because of their decisions, their reasons for leaving the church, for turning their backs on Joseph Smith and turning their backs on the saints in Missouri. When he says beginning in verse 41, that no power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, by persuasion, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, Joseph Smith doesn't like high-mindedness. And I think it's actually brought out in this revelation. Why are these verses in? I think Joseph Smith has learned in Liberty Jail that there's only one way you can exercise priesthood authority in this church, and that is not by lording it over the people, lording over position, or being one of high standing in the church. The way the priesthood is exercised is by the Christ-like virtues of long-suffering, kindness, pure knowledge, gentleness, meekness, love unfeigned.
Doctrine and Covenants, section 121, verse 34, all the way to the end of section 122 is lifted as an unbroken piece right out of the Liberty Jail epistle. Section 122, verse 1, begins this way.
The ends of the earth shall inquire after thy name. What's he saying here is, Joseph Smith, your legacy is going to be very long term. People will look to you for years and years to come as the, founder, as the prophet of the restoration. And thy voice shall be more terrible in the midst of thine enemies than the fierce lion because of thy righteousness, and thy God shall stand by thee forever and ever. I think that's a direct allusion to Joseph Smith rebuking the guards in Richmond in November of 1838. But we have some other kinds of things here that are very, very interesting. And what follows is the conditions, what Joseph Smith and others may suffer for the gospel's sake. And that's why these words are used. If thou art accused with all manner of false accusations, if thine enemies fall upon thee, if they tear thee from the society of thy father and thy mother and brethren and sisters, and if with a drawn sword thine enemies tear thee from the bosom of thy wife and of thine offspring, and thine elder son, although but 6 years of age, shall cling to thy garments and shall say, my father, why can't you stay with us? O my father, what are the men going to do with you? And if then he shall be thrust from thee by the sword, and thou shalt be dragged to prison, and thine enemies prowl around thee like wolves for the blood of the Lamb. And then he says, know thou, my son, which is quite a tender appellation, that all these things shall give thee experience and shall be for thy good. What Joseph Smith learned there was, the man who is a disciple of Christ better be able to suffer persecution for Christ.
It's interesting to me that in the Liberty Jail, some of the other prisoners talked about, well, maybe they'll kill us. And Joseph doesn't seem to be bothered by that at all. He doesn't seem to think that that's what's going to happen. Maybe verse 9 of section 22 reflects that optimism that he had about his own life when he says, thy priesthood shall remain, for their bounds are set. They cannot pass. Thy days are known, and thy years shall not be numbered less. Therefore, fear not what man can do, for God will be with you forever and ever.
I believe the Lord's assuring Joseph Smith, you'll never be taken before your time. You're going to get out of here. There's a lot more to do. There's a lot more revelation that's coming. The restoration's not complete. And you think about it, when is the greatest, what are the greatest teachings of Joseph Smith to come? Temple, endowment, eternal marriage, baptism for the dead, salvation for the dead. Some of the greatest teachings of Joseph Smith that he gives are yet to come. Nauvoo's that time.
At this point then, at the close of the material that is section 122 in the original epistle, there's a break and there's counsel from the prophet Joseph. Then immediately following begins the material we now call section 123.
With section 123, they are to form a committee to take testimony of all that had been suffered in Missouri and to get it into a record. And the published record is several inches thick as each person described what happened to them and the property they lost and lives lost and all of the terrible things that happened to them.
Latter-day Saints love the sections 121, 122. So powerful, so expressive, so full of hope. And then we get to section 123 and they go, why would Orson Pratt put that in there? And I think it's quite evident that if you understood that Joseph Smith knows, of course, the Missouri chapter is about over, he wants to make darn well good and sure that that chapter is not forgotten and that that chapter of Missouri Mormon history is played out for years to come. He wants people to know how badly treated we were in Missouri. So he admonishes the saints. We've got to go and we've got to write down, swear out an affidavit, a petition, a sworn statement, whatever, before a justice of the peace and detail in writing what happened to you in Missouri. And he says it's our responsibility to do this before we can safely call God out of the heavens and expect his mercy and blessings upon us.
Joseph closed out this 29-page epistle, interestingly, by bearing his testimony and invoking heaven's blessings upon his people. 3 weeks later, they left Liberty Jail, soon to find freedom with the saints in Illinois.
And so Joseph has now been in that jail for 5 months. He himself never characterized it as a temple. Some have called it the jail temple. And with regard to what was contained in this letter, there certainly is some justification. It was a sanctifying process, no question. But the sanctification was to the souls of the inmates, not to the stones of the building. He called it by a lot of other names, none of them particularly complimentary.
In another letter from Liberty Jail that was written earlier, Joseph Smith spoke to a friend and in that letter described the experience of Liberty Jail and the effect that it had upon him. He said this,
I was glad to see you. No tongue can tell what expressible joy it gives a man to see the face of one who has been a friend after having been enclosed in the wall of a prison for 5 months. It seems to me that my heart will always be more tender after this than it ever was before.
And it is right there that we will begin next week. There are institutions of religion, and then there is the practice of religion as described by the Apostle James in the New Testament. Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, the pure religion of Joseph Smith. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.